Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers. I'm James Barte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Today is Wednesday, March 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden urged Congress to take action to curb gun violence.
I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common sense steps.
Plus, Turkey is deepening its ties with China.
China is now among Turkey's biggest investors. Traditional European investors are withdrawing.
And zoonotic research in the Philippines aimed at preventing the next pandemic. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden is urging Congress to toughen the nation's gun laws after the Colorado supermarket shooting. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
It was the nation's deadliest shooting in a year and a half, its seventh mass killing this year, just a week after the Atlanta shootings.
While the flag was still flying half-staff,
the president says while a lot is unknown about the Boulder shootings,
I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common sense steps.
He's pushing Congress to ban assault rifles like the one used and wants the Senate to approve tighter background check measures the House already passed.
We have to act.
The president says lawmakers must end years of inaction on gun violence by banning assault rifles and passing House-approved measures to close background check loopholes.
This is not, it should not be a partisan issue.
On Capitol Hill,
this Senate will be different.
Democratic leader Chuck Schumer promised to vote on the bills, but at a hearing on gun control measures scheduled before the shooting, it was clear Republicans are not budging.
Every time there's a shooting, we play this ridiculous theater.
With Ted Cruz saying Democrats each time propose measures that would do nothing to actually stop gun violence. Prospects for any major reforms are unlikely on a closely divided Capitol Hill. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Police on Tuesday identified the 21-year-old suspect accused of killing 10 people, including a policeman, at the Colorado supermarket. The suspect stormed the King Supers outlet armed with an AR-style semi-automatic rifle and a handgun while wearing a tactical vest. The suspect was released from a hospital where he was being treated for a leg wound suffered in an exchange of gunfire with responding police and transported to the county jail on Tuesday afternoon to await an initial court appearance on murder and other charges. U.S. lawmakers are taking a new look at a decades-old law that grants U.S. presidents sweeping powers to wage war overseas. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson explains how the president secured those powers when Congress is given the power to declare war by the U.S. Constitution.
That's right. Well, to go back to where we got to, we have to go back to the September 11th terrorist attack. So you're really talking about 2 decades that this issue has been languishing on Capitol Hill. And that's really because U.S. lawmakers have allowed it to languish. In the immediate days after those September 11th terrorist attacks, they gave the U.S. president basically very broad-ranging powers to defend the U.S. overseas. Remember, the U.S. Constitution gives them and only them the power to declare war. But by ceding that authority, they really opened up this, you know, box of trouble for the U.S. overseas and gave the president broad powers to conduct airstrikes, to broadly define who a U.S. enemy abroad was. And really, everyone at this point, both Democrat and Republican, has recognized that that's really gotten out of hand, that presidents are using that power in ways that couldn't have even been imagined in 2001 and 2002, and that they need to bring back some of that power to Capitol Hill.
You mentioned that this has been an issue that has long been languishing within the halls of Capitol Hill, and that, you know, there's bipartisan support to kind of review things and reassert their congressional power. So what did the hearing today reveal in terms of what the Democrats and the Republicans were thinking?
Well, I can say that in my years up on Capitol Hill, I have seen multiple efforts to repeal these authorizations, which in shorthand are known as AUMFs. And all of those efforts have failed up until now. What's really different is the occupant of the White House. President Biden was up on Capitol Hill, as we know, for many, many decades. And he really, while he was up there, took an interest in congressional war powers and pulling some of that back from the White House. So now lawmakers have a sympathetic voice in the White House who is saying, look, I realize that the executive branch authority has grown far too large and that Congress rightly should make these really grave decisions about how to spend this much money on the military, who to send into harm's way, how to get the U.S. involved. That needs to be decided by the people who are elected by the people of the United States. And so there is this sense up on Capitol Hill that something can be worked out, some language where they repeal the old AUMF and they do a much, much narrower framework where it's very specifically defined who the president can go to war against, who he can order airstrikes against, and that if he goes over that authority, steps over that line, then Congress will have the ability to yank his funding and say, no, you are going too far. We're taking this a step back.
Now, is there any indication as to where things are going to go after Tuesday's hearing in terms of legislation being brought forward?
Right. So we know that Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who has really been a longtime voice on this issue, has already introduced legislation in the U.S. Senate. It looks like these hearings are preparing the way for similar House legislation to go through. Obviously, that is going to be a long process, and it is going to be hard to get some Republican lawmakers on board because they say that we still need to give the president some broad-ranging authority to conduct terrorist airstrikes and to protect the United States. Democrats, of course, argue that there is nothing that is going to limit the president's power to defend the U.S. against a direct attack. We'll have to see how that argument plays out and if they can reconcile those two pieces of legislation.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Tuesday pledged to rebuild and revitalize the transatlantic military alliance after a bruising 4 years when Washington portrayed NATO as outdated, divided, and in crisis. The first top U.S. official to visit NATO since President Joe Biden took office in January, Blinken said that the alliance was at a pivotal moment, but could emerge stronger after internal disputes over Turkey and Russian gas. An EU official said Biden will join a video conference of European Union leaders on Thursday as part of that renewal. The detained leader of Myanmar's ousted democratic government is due in court Wednesday, as the aftermath of the February 1st military coup continues to rock the Southeast Asian country. Reporter Philip Sherwell is monitoring the situation from Bangkok, Thailand, and he tells me that Aung San Suu Kyi is facing several charges, with the possibility of more yet to come.
Well, she was detained overnight on February the 1st when the coup was staged by the generals, and the immediate charge brought it against her, and it really did have the feel of a sort of let's get something in place so we have an excuse to hold her in detention, was that the walkie-talkies were found in her residence in the capital, Naypyidaw, and these were allegedly illegal, now either illegally imported or not correctly registered, and Aung San Suu Kyi would not have been using walkie-talkies herself, but her staff undoubtedly would have been. And this was under an old law that they've used to sort of ban people in the past for having mobile phones, even fax machines back in the day. So they brought that charge. Then they followed up with charges that she had broken the country's pandemic law by campaigning and canvassing for votes during November's elections. And then they followed up with a couple of sort of broader charges, a sweeping one of incitement, which is that allegedly she caused unrest or fear in the country. It's not even clear what they were referring to, and it kind of struck people as very ironic, given that this was the military regime that actually staged the coup and had staged a military crackdown, that they were accusing her of causing unrest.
In addition to these charges, there's also been some new allegations leveled against Aung San Suu Kyi. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, now these are much more serious accusations, potentially, in terms of the military's mission of prosecuting her, convicting her and ruling her out of a role in public life in Myanmar in future. Twice in recent days, there have been what looked like highly staged and orchestrated statements on state television read out that have implicated her in sort of alleged very large corruption. One was by a a businessman who's got very heavy ties to the military and indeed was once convicted of drug dealing to the children of generals. He alleged that he had given her several times in envelopes about $500,000 in local currency. And then most recently, the former chief minister of Yangon has made similar accusations in a televised statement where it didn't even seem as though the words that we were hearing were matching his movements of his lips.
Philip, we've been watching the protests, which have unfortunately turned deadly in Myanmar over the past month. What's taking place today on the streets?
Well, very interestingly, nothing is going on in most of the main cities, and that's the point. The civil disobedience movement today called a silent strike. They actually said, you know, some of their organizers said they were reacting to this increasingly violent crackdown in which people were, unarmed protesters were being mowed down and killed and grievously injured. So they've urged people to stay home, don't shop, don't work. And their message that they put out today is we can shut down any city in Myanmar. So that's what's happening. And it's sending a very strong message. They will doubtless be back on the streets at some stage. But today, it's the silent strike.
Philip Sherwell reports from Bangkok, Thailand. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
I recently shared the sounds of Mars captured by NASA's Perseverance rover a day or so after its February 18th touchdown on the Red Planet. The space agency is sending the rover on short trips across the surface of Mars. Controllers on Earth switched on Perseverance's sensitive onboard microphone to capture the sounds as the rover rolled over the surface of Mars on a recent 27.3-meter-long trip. This is Perseverance on the move on Mars. Vandy Verma, the rover driver at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, says that people don't realize that the rover's wheels are actually made of metal. And when driving across Mars with these wheels, it's actually very noisy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A French tourist has been detained for the past 10 months in Tehran on charges of espionage. France is working to gain his release, but has made no public demand for it. As Nicolas Pinault reports from Paris, the case highlights the difficulties that U.S. allies are facing as they work to carefully revive the Iran nuclear deal.
Benjamin Briere is a French tourist who was arrested last May while visiting Iran with his drone and minivan. Still detained, he was charged with espionage and spreading propaganda against the system. His lawyers denied the charges. If found guilty, he could be sentenced to death. Breyer's case is the latest in a series against foreigners at a time of heightened tensions between Iran and the West over Iran's nuclear activities. Bernard Wurkod is a geographer and Iran specialist. He thinks that the cases against these French tourists and the 2019 arrest of the French-Iranian academic Fariba Abdelkader are separate issues which would have no impact on the JCPOA talks or other negotiations between the two countries. France, along with Britain, Germany, and the European Union, are trying to bring the United States and Iran to the table for informal talks as a first step toward reviving Tehran's 2015 nuclear deal, also known as JCPOA, which lifted international sanctions on the Islamic Republic in exchange for curbs to its nuclear program. However, tensions are growing over Tehran's nuclear activities, and U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken last month said Iran is heading to the wrong direction. Jean-Yves Le Drian, France's foreign minister, echoed those concerns.
Les activités nucléaires iraniennes se développent.
Le Drian recently told a French Senate hearing that Iran's nuclear activities were developing in violation of the Vienna Agreement. The minister also added that Iran conducted attacks in Iraq and Saudi Arabia to destabilize those countries. So it is crucial to start de-escalation to ease tensions, he added. A source with the French Foreign Ministry told VOA the French government has been in regular contact with Brière, but French officials have stuck to their regular strategy of maintaining discretion when dealing with Iran in order to increase the chances of obtaining the release of their citizens. Analysts point to Iranian leaders' history of using hostages to get what they want. Mohammad Reza Jalili is an honorary professor of international relations at the Geneva Graduate Institute.
La prise en otage des diplomates américains en 1979.
He describes the hostage situation in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979 as the founding act for Iranian Islamic diplomacy. Jalili presents an Iranian policy to take Western hostages as a diplomatic weapon to release their own pro-regime citizens sentenced in France, Belgium, and other countries. Iran seems very interested in dual citizens to gain leverage, according to Jalili. The most recent high-profile releases of foreign prisoners in Iran of American Xiyu Wang in December 2019, American Michael White in March 2020, and Frenchman Roland Marshall also in March, were all accompanied by the release of Iranians held abroad on sanction-busting charges. The case highlights for Western countries the complexity of dealing with Iran. Analysts say European countries appear to have less leverage than the United States does.
Paris, vous le savez, a essayé à plusieurs reprises de faire les go-between.
Urquhart says France has tried several times to bring together Iran and United States and resume talks, but overall, France and Europe are weak partners if neither Washington nor Tehran has the political will to act. Therefore, Europeans are waiting to see how the situation will evolve. The presidential election is scheduled for June 18th in Iran, and many observers believe that no major negotiations could resume before the poll. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Turkey is deepening its economic ties with China despite a growing international outcry over Beijing's treatment of its Uyghur Muslim minority. Dorian Jones reports analysts say the subject of the Uyghurs is not likely to come up in conversations later this week, when China's foreign minister visits Turkey.
This month saw China's Xiaomi open a mobile telephone factory in Istanbul. Turkey's technology minister Mustafa Varank was on hand to celebrate the latest Chinese investment. The Xiaomi factory is just the latest in a fast-developing Turkish-Chinese partnership.
Certainly, economic aspect, bilateral trade especially, that saw an exponential rise since 2000 or so in the last 20 years. And in the final 4 or 5 years, I would say it got much closer, not only in the economic sense, but in the political ideological sense as well.
China recently bought out an Italian company's stake in Istanbul's landmark new third bridge. China is now among Turkey's biggest investors. Traditional European investors are withdrawing as their governments punish Ankara over human rights. Measures, as some argue, are pushing Turkey away from the West.
This hostile actions against Turkey will eventually not force, but let's say, lineate Turkey with the Eurasian and Asian forces, Asian powers like Russia and China. Right now, the Asian century started.
Beijing is also increasingly providing Ankara financial support in its efforts to prop up the plummeting Turkish currency. China is also a leading supplier of COVID vaccines to Turkey. Turkey's deepening ties with China have seen Ankara remain largely silent over Beijing's crackdown on its predominantly Muslim Uyghur minority. But within government circles, there is unease over China's growing influence.
China is coming from the east, and it is going to bite. It is going to bite all of us. You see their human rights records. They are killing people in Uyghur territories.
Turkey is one of the main hosts of Uyghur refugees, including many dissidents. Ahead of Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Li's visit, reports say Beijing has presented Ankara with a list of Uyghur dissidents it wants extradited. With the Turkish currency under increasing pressure, support from China could be vital, forcing Ankara into a difficult choice. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Israelis went to the polls for the fourth time in 2 years Tuesday. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, already Israel's longest-serving prime minister, is hoping for another term, but is under strong pressure from the opposition to leave. Linda Gradstein has this update.
Voter turnout Tuesday was high, despite voter fatigue among Israelis who have done this three times before in the past 2 years. Analysts here say this election is a clear referendum on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is currently on trial for corruption. Netanyahu's main challenge is coming from a centrist former TV personality named Yair Lapid, who hopes to capitalize on public dissatisfaction with Netanyahu's handling of the coronavirus crisis and allegations of corruption to unseat him. The election is being held as Israel's COVID-19 situation has improved dramatically. More than 4.6 million Israelis, about half the population, are fully vaccinated, and health officials say Israel is well on its way to herd immunity. Another 15% of the population has recovered from COVID-19, while more than 6,000 have died. Dean Livneh, the legal advisor to Israel's Central Election Committee, talks about special accommodations made for those who have the virus.
The CC, the Central Elections Committee, will take any voter who is sick on Elections Day at home with a special car that has separation between the driver and the voter to the polling station and back. And so everyone will know that the sick doesn't go out to the streets.
Either side needs to win 61 out of 120 seats in the Israeli parliament. It could be several weeks until Israelis know who will lead their next government. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
At a news conference, World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says COVID-19 numbers worldwide are going in the wrong direction.
After 6 weeks of declining cases in January and February, we have now had 4 straight weeks of increases. And last week, the number of deaths rose for the first time in 7 weeks.
He went on to say not all countries are doing a good job with vaccinations. AstraZeneca will publish up-to-date results from its major U.S. COVID-19 vaccine trial after health officials publicly criticized the drug maker for using, quote, outdated information to show how well the immunization worked. The rare public rebuke marks the latest setback for the vaccine, once hailed as a milestone in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic, that has since been dogged by questions over its effectiveness and possible side effects. The AstraZeneca vaccine is seen as crucial in tackling the spread of COVID-19 across the globe because it is easier and cheaper to transport than rival shots. The vaccine has been granted conditional marketing or emergency use authorization in more than 70 countries. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has this story of research in the Philippines to prevent future pandemics.
Nighttime in the Philippines. A team of scientists using nets captures a wild bat which receives an impromptu medical screening. Scientists swab the animal's mouth, take measurements, and inspect the wings.
What we're trying to look into are other strains of coronavirus that have the potential to jump to humans.
Bat ecologist Philip Alviola with the University of the Philippines is on the research team studying bats and zoonotic diseases. The very nature of their work puts them at risk of contagion. They use the data collected from health screening bats to create a simulation model.
If we know the virus itself and where we know where it came from, we know how to isolate that virus geographically. So we can implement some restriction, travel restrictions. We can prevent city to city, province to province transmission.
The model projects how time, climate, and temperature may affect the transmission of disease from bats to humans. The International Union for Conservation of Nature says there are more than 1,200 species of bats, and at least 78 of them live in the Philippines. The World Health Organization and others have been studying whether the coronavirus pandemic started in bats because the virus has a similar makeup to others that the flying mammals are known to carry. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
A report by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program warns many of the more than 174 million people suffering from acute hunger across the world are likely to die without urgent international assistance. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Those most affected by acute hunger are people living in 20 so-called hotspots. Topping the list of areas where people face catastrophic levels of acute hunger are Yemen, South Sudan, and northern Nigeria. The director of the FAO office in Geneva, Dominique Bourgeon, says multiple drivers are behind the soaring rates of acute hunger. He says those factors are interlinked and mutually reinforcing in most of the hotspots.
These multiple drivers are, first, conflict or other forms of armed violence as a result of the economic impact of COVID-19 pandemic. We also wish to flag that the economies of numerous countries in 2021 will continue to be highly vulnerable to economic shocks.
While the majority of affected countries are in Africa, the report warns acute hunger is due to rise steeply in most regions of the world. Among those most at risk are Afghanistan in Asia, Syria and Lebanon in the Middle East, and Haiti in the Caribbean. The report finds more than 34 million people already are facing emergency levels of food insecurity, with many on the brink of famine. It notes families in pockets of South Sudan and Yemen already are in danger of starvation and death. Director of the World Food Program's office in Geneva, Annalisa Conte, says people facing famine-like conditions have depleted their assets, lost their livelihoods, do not have enough to eat, and most of their children already are acutely malnourished.
Excess death due to hunger is taking place as we speak. You need to understand that beyond this point, there is starvation and widespread mortality. The window to avert a catastrophic situation, I would say of a biblical proportion, is closing fast.
The UN food agencies are calling on international donors to provide $5 billion in emergency food assistance to prevent 34 million people at risk of famine from starving to death. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ahead of World Tuberculosis Day, doctors are warning that progress in the global fight against the disease has been set back more than a decade by the coronavirus pandemic. Henry Ridgewell takes it from here.
Tuberculosis killed 1.4 million people worldwide in 2019. In 2020, the coronavirus pandemic overwhelmed health services across the world. In 9 countries with a high prevalence of TB, among them India, Pakistan, South Africa, and Indonesia, diagnosis and treatment fell by an average of 23%, according to analysis by the Stop TB Partnership, a non-profit hosted by the United Nations in Geneva. They say the fight against TB has been set back by 12 years. Dr. Luchika Ditiu is the executive director of the partnership.
It's an impact on all the work that we tried to do, but also the finances that were spent, all the efforts of everyone. We are basically back to kind of square one of that time.
Like COVID-19, tuberculosis is a disease of the lungs caused by bacteria rather than a virus. Again, Dr. Luchika Ditiu.
A lot of the people that are dealing with TB, doctors, nurses, healthcare workers, providers, were shifted from TB to COVID.
Hospital wards used for TB patients were rapidly converted into emergency COVID-19 units. As countries imposed lockdowns to fight the pandemic, TB diagnosis and treatment were again hit hard.
And are the ones that have a lot of difficulties in reaching the healthcare. And one of the reasons can be distance, can be money, such as poverty and other barriers. These things were actually exacerbated on COVID.
That means many patients are badly infected by the time they reach any clinic or hospital.
That's what a lot of the clinicians are saying, that they observe now some very, very bad forms of tuberculosis that they didn't see in many years. These bad forms of TB means that mortality will be higher. It also means that transmission within the household will be bigger.
Dittew says there is an opportunity to claw back lost progress. The coronavirus pandemic has forced healthcare providers and communities closer together. By combining testing, contact tracing, and treatment for COVID and TB, both diseases can be tackled at the same time. Scientists say urgent investment is also needed in new TB vaccines and treatments. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America.